You know, I was messing around with my phone this morning trying to change the wallpaper.
Oh, yeah.
And I realized I've spent more time customizing my notification settings than I have on almost anything else this week.
Right. We obsess over those
We
things.
do, because we hate the factory defaults. We
Yeah.
want everything custom tailored to us.
It's true. We assume the default settings are, generic, probably inefficient, and definitely not designed for our specific needs.
Exactly. But it struck me that when it comes to the biggest commitment of our lives, marriage, most of us just sort of shrug and accept the factory settings. We don't even read the user manual. We just sign on the dotted line and assume the default is the romantic fairy tale option.
And that is such a dangerous assumption because in South Africa, the default setting for marriage, known as marriage and community of property, isn't just a romantic concept.
It's not.
It's a rigid legal and financial regime. And unlike your phone, there is no reset button you can hit when things go wrong.
That is exactly what we are unpacking today. We're doing a deep dive into the hidden costs of saying, I do.
We are. We're looking at the legal machinery of the joint estate, the terrifying reality of shared debt.
And a specific case study that will make you want to go check your marriage certificate immediately.
We're going to decode what actually happens to your money and, crucially, your debt when you get married without signing a contract beforehand.
And stick around, because we're going to cover a specific aha moment regarding something called the domino effect in debt review that frankly scared the living daylights out of me.
It is a sobering reality check, but a necessary one.
So let's start with the basics. What is this default setting we're talking about?
Okay.
If I get married in South Africa today and I don't go to a lawyer, I don't sign an antenuptial contract, what happens?
If you don't sign an antenuptial contract, or ANC, you are automatically married in community of property.
Automatically.
Silence is consent. The law just assumes that if you didn't specify otherwise, you intended to merge everything.
Merge everything. I mean, that sounds nice and communal, like we are building a village.
It sounds lovely, but legally it creates what we call a joint estate. The best analogy for this is the single pot.
Okay, let's visualize this.
Imagine a massive cooking pot in the middle of your kitchen. The moment the marriage officer declares you husband and wife, the law takes every single asset you own.
Every asset.
Your car, your savings, that apartment you bought in your 20s, and just dumps it into that pot.
Wait, even the stuff I owned before I met my spouse.
Everything, unless it was specifically excluded in a will like an inheritance where the giver said, "This is for you only." It goes into the pot. And at the same time, everything your spouse owns goes into the same pot.
So my hard-earned savings and their collection of vintage comic books are now effectively a soup.
Correct. It creates a total merger of financial identity. You cease to be two separate financial entities and become one single legal entity.
Which, to be fair, is designed for equality, right? The sources mention that this regime was created to protect spouses who might not earn an income.
Precisely. Traditionally, women who stayed home to raise children. The logic is, we are a team. We win together, we lose together. Both spouses have equal decision-making power and share equally in the profits. If one of you wins the lotto, the joint estate wins the lotto.
But here is where it gets interesting. And by interesting, I mean stressful.
Yeah.
The pot doesn't just collect assets.
No. And this is the detail that catches people completely off guard. The pot collects all the debts, too.
So, if I have a student loan from 10 years ago that I'm still paying off,
That is now a liability of the joint estate.
and if my partner has a maxed out credit card from their wild years before we met,
That is now your debt, too. You are legally merging your credit histories and your liabilities.
that feels like a massive leap of faith. You aren't just marrying a person, you're marrying their entire financial history.
And their future financial behavior. And this brings us to the most critical concept in this entire deep dive. Joint liability.
Right, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because usually when I think of debt, I think of a signature. If I sign for a loan, I pay it back. If I don't sign, it's not my problem.
That logic applies if you are single or married with an ANC. But in community of property, the rules of physics change.
How so?
Because the estate is shared, the liability is shared.
So walk me through a scenario. Let's say I want to start a business.
Okay.
I go to the bank, I take out a personal loan for startup capital. My spouse thinks it's a terrible idea. They don't sign the papers. They don't want anything to do with it. Am I the only one on the hook?
No, in most cases, the signature of one spouse binds the joint estate,
Even if they didn't sign.
even if they didn't sign. The creditor, the bank, doesn't look at you and them, they look at the estate.
So if I default on that loan,
the bank can come after the assets in the pot to settle the debt, which implies they can attach assets that your spouse might consider theirs.
Let's make this even more specific. Say my wife has a store account, you know, for clothes or something, and she falls behind on payments.
Right, it's in arrears.
The store hands it over to debt collectors. Can they come after my salary?
Technically, yes, because your salary is an asset of the joint estate. A creditor can legally attach joint bank accounts, vehicles, and yes, garnish income to satisfy a debt incurred by the other spouse.
That creates a scenario where I could be working to pay off a wardrobe I didn't buy and didn't approve of?
Exactly, and it gets worse. Let's talk about asset attachment. Suppose you owned a house before you got married. It's in your name. You paid the deposit. It's your pride and joy.
I'm guessing I know where this is going.
Once you marry in community of property, that house is in the pot.
Right.
If your spouse incurs a massive debt, maybe a gambling debt or a failed business venture, the creditors can apply to the court to sell that house to pay the debt.
Even though I bought it before the marriage.
The timeline doesn't matter to the creditor. The only thing that matters is that the house is now part of the joint estate and the joint estate owes the money.
That is terrifying. It really redefines what trust means. It's not just emotional trust. It's competency trust.
You are effectively acting as an unlimited insurer for every financial decision your partner makes.
To really drive this home, the source material provided a case study that I found incredibly relatable. The Naidus.
Yes, Mr. and Mrs. Naidu. This isn't some high-stakes corporate fraud. It's a very suburban, everyday nightmare.
So let's look at the timeline. Mr. and Mrs. Naidu get married in 2018.
Okay.
They don't sign an ANC, so they are in community of property.
The default setting. Everything is fine for about 5 years. Then in 2023, Mr. Naidu decides he needs a new car.
And here's the crucial detail. He doesn't tell Mrs. Naidu. He just goes to the dealership, picks out a shiny new vehicle, and signs the vehicle finance agreement.
Now, you might ask, doesn't she have to sign?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
For immovable property like a house, yes, both need to sign. But for movable property like a car or for credit agreements, one spouse can often bind the estate without the other's written consent.
So he drives a car home, maybe tells her it's a company car, or maybe he just avoids the conversation.
Who knows? But then financial reality hits. Mr. Naidu defaults on the payments.
He stops paying.
He stops paying. The finance company tries to collect. He can't pay. So they initiate legal proceedings.
And Mrs. Naidu gets a summons.
Imagine her shock. She's named in a lawsuit for a debt she didn't sign for regarding a car she might not even drive.
She must have thought, there's a mistake. Get my name off this.
Probably. But the verdict was clear. Because they were married in community of property, the finance company had the absolute legal right to pursue both of them.
They were claiming against the joint estate.
The joint estate. So Mrs. Naidu was fully liable, jointly and severally. That means the bank could take assets that she considered hers to pay for his car.
It really strips away the defense of, I didn't know.
No, ignorance is not a defense in a joint estate. You are legally tethered. If he sinks, you sink.
And speaking of sinking, this brings us to the concept of debt review. This was the part of the research that I found most claustrophobic.
It is a trap that many people don't see coming. Debt review, under the National Credit Act, is supposed to be a lifeline. If you are drowning in debt, a debt counselor steps in, restructures your payments, and protects you from legal action while you pay it off.
Okay, it's rehab for your finances. But how does that work if you are in the single pot?
That's the problem. You cannot enter debt review in isolation. Because there's only one estate, the debt counselor has to assess the entire estate.
This is what the note's called, the domino effect.
Exactly. If your spouse has racked up unmanageable debt and needs to go under debt review, they cannot do it alone. You must apply jointly.
So let's say I have perfect credit. I pay my bills on time. I have zero debt. But my spouse is drowning.
Yeah.
I have to go under debt review too.
You have no choice. The application is joint. And the consequences are joint.
What does that mean for me practically?
It means your income is included in the restructuring calculation. Your expenses are scrutinized. But most importantly, your credit record is flagged at the bureaus.
So I get a debt review stamp on my forehead.
Essentially, both spouses are listed as being under debt review. This means you are frozen out of the credit market.
So if I wanted to apply for a job that does a credit check, or I wanted to rent an apartment or just get a cell phone contract,
you would likely be rejected. You cannot incur new debt while under review. You are financially paralyzed because of your partner's situation.
And you can't get out until the debt is paid.
Until a clearance certificate is issued for the entire estate, You are locked in.
That is incredibly heavy. It feels like you lose your autonomy completely.
You do. That is the price of the single pot. You cannot clean just half the water. If the water is poisoned, the whole pot is poisoned.
Okay, we have painted a very grim picture here. I think we've successfully terrified everyone listening who is currently dating.
I mean...
But obviously, people do get married without taking on this level of risk. There's an alternative.
There is. And frankly, it is the option that most legal and financial experts recommend. It's called marrying out of community of property.
This is where the antenuptial contract, the ANC, comes in.
Yes. You visit a lawyer before the wedding. I cannot stress the before enough. You sign a contract that says, effectively, we are keeping our estates separate.
So instead of one pot, we have two pots.
Two pots. What is mine is mine. What is yours. Assets acquired before the marriage stay separate. Assets acquired during the marriage stay in the name of the person who bought them.
And the debts.
This is the liability shield. The debts remain separate. If you marry with an ANC and your spouse takes out that business loan and defaults, the bank can only come after your spouse.
So in the Naidu example, if they had an ANC.
If they had an ANC, the bank could have repossessed Mr. Naidu's car. They could have sued him for the balance, but they could not have touched Mrs. Naidu.
At all?
Not at all. Her assets, her salary, her credit record, all would have been safe.
That seems like a no-brainer. But I know what some people say. It feels cold. It feels like we are planning for divorce.
Yeah, that is the emotional objection. But there is a version of the ANC that addresses this. It's called the accrual system.
Right. The sources mention this. How does that differ?
So with the accrual system, you still have two separate pots during the marriage. You still have the liability shield. I am not liable for your debts.
Okay.
But if the marriage ends by death or divorce, we look at how much each person's wealth grew during the marriage, and we share that growth equally.
Oh, that makes sense. So if I'm the breadwinner and I build a huge company and you stay home and manage the household, you aren't left with nothing.
No, you get half of the growth.
So you share the profits.
Exactly. You share the profits, the accrual, but you don't share the daily risks of insolvency. It's generally considered the fairest system.
But the key takeaway for today is that any form of ANC protects you from that joint liability nightmare.
Correct. The separation of estates is the key.
Now, I want to pivot to the listeners who are sitting there thinking, well, this is great info, but I've been married for 5 years and we didn't sign anything.
Right.
They are already in the default regime. Is it game over?
It's not game over, but you are definitely playing on hard mode. If you are already in community of property, you can't just wish it away.
Can you switch? Can you sign a contract now?
You can, but it is not a simple administrative task. It's called a postnuptial contract.
Post meaning after.
Yes. But to do this, you have to apply to the High Court. You have to hire a lawyer. It is expensive. We are talking tens of thousands of rands usually.
And you have to ask permission.
You have to ask the court permission.
Yeah.
And you have to notify all your creditors. You have to advertise it in the newspaper.
Why?
To prove you aren't doing it just to hide assets from people you owe money to. If you are already drowning in debt, the court won't let you switch regimes just to dodge the creditors.
You have to be solvent.
You have to be solvent. So it's a difficult, expensive fix.
Okay, so what if you can't afford that? What if you are just stuck in the single pot? How do you survive?
The first survival tool is aggressive communication. And I don't mean, how was your day? I mean, financial nudity.
Total transparency.
Total. In a community of property marriage, secrets are dangerous. You need to know every account your spouse has. You need to know if they are applying for credit. You cannot afford to be polite about money.
The Naidu case proves that. If she had known he was buying the car, maybe they could have had a conversation about affordability before he signed the deal.
Exactly. The sources also suggest a tactic that might feel a bit uncomfortable. Surveillance.
Surveillance. Like hiring a private investigator.
You know, no, simpler than that. Credit report monitoring. You should be checking your credit report and your spouse's regularly. Use apps like ClearScore or TransUnion.
Why check mine if I haven't done anything?
Because of the joint estate. If your spouse opens an account and defaults, the judgment might show up on your profile. Your credit report is your early warning radar.
So if I see an inquiry from a bank I didn't approach, alarm bells should be ringing.
Big alarm bells. And if they do ring, if you realize your spouse is being reckless gambling, buying things you can't afford, destroying the estate.
What can you do?
You have to move fast. The law does provide mechanisms to protect the estate from a reckless spouse. You can apply to the court to suspend your spouse's power to bind the estate.
So basically get a judge to take away their credit card.
In a legal sense, yes. You can get a court order that says they cannot sell assets or incur debt without your specific written consent.
That sounds like a nuclear option.
It is. It's usually a precursor to divorce. But if the ship is sinking, you have to plug the hole. You cannot let politeness destroy your financial future.
This has been a real eye-opener. I think we've stripped away a lot of the romance, but hopefully replaced it with some necessary caution.
I always say the most romantic thing you can do is protect your partner's future. And sometimes that means signing a contract that keeps your debts to yourself.
So let's recap. The default setting marriage in community of property is a single pot.
It merges everything, assets and debts.
And it creates joint liability.
Yeah.
If one spouse signs, the estate pays.
If one spouse goes under, both go under.
The alternative, the ANC, creates two pots and a liability shield.
It keeps you safe from your partner's financial stumbles.
And if you are already in the default regime, communicate, monitor those credit reports, and don't be afraid to seek legal help if you see reckless behavior.
That's it.
We usually end with a final thought, and today I want to leave you with this perspective. We often think of marriage vows as poetry. For richer or for poorer.
It's beautiful. It's emotional.
It is. But in the eyes of the law, specifically here in South Africa, those vows are not poetry.
No, they're not.
They are a signature on an unlimited liability contract. Think about it.
Yeah.
If your best friend or even a business partner you respect came to you and said, sign this contract. It says, if I ever go broke, you go broke too.
Right.
If I borrow money and lose it, you have to pay it back and you can't opt out. Would you sign it?
You would run for the hills.
You absolutely would.
Yeah.
Yet when we fall in love, so many of us sign it without even reading the fine print. Maybe it's time we started treating the marriage contract with the same scrutiny we give a cell phone contract.
I couldn't agree more.
Thanks for diving deep with us today. Go check those marriage certificates, everyone.
See you next time.